From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A young white male suspected of killing 9 people in a South Carolina church has been captured. Authorities announced Thursday that 21-year-old Dylan Roof, suspected of carrying out a mass shooting that killed 9 people and injured several others at the historic Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, was captured. He was arrested in North Carolina. Photos of the alleged shooter shared on social media show him wearing flag patches of apartheid-era South Africa and the former racist state of Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe. President Barack Obama addressed the shootings at a press conference Thursday.
Michelle and I know several members of Emmanuel AME Church. We knew their pastor, Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who, along with 8 others, gathered in prayer and fellowship and was murdered last night. And to say our thoughts and prayers are with them and their families and their community doesn't say enough to convey the heartache and the sadness and the anger that we feel. Any death of this sort is a tragedy. Any shooting involving multiple victims is a tragedy. There is something particularly heartbreaking about a death happening in a place in which we seek solace and we seek peace, in a place of worship. And Mother Emmanuel is, in fact, more than a church. This is a place of worship that was founded by African Americans seeking liberty. This is a church that was burned to the ground because its worshipers worked to end slavery. When there were laws banning all black church gatherings, they conducted services in secret. When there was a nonviolent movement to bring our country closer in line with our highest ideals, some of our brightest leaders spoke and led marches from this church's steps. This is a sacred place in the history of Charleston and in the history of America. The FBI is now on the scene with local police, and more of the Bureau's best are on the way to join them. The Attorney General has announced plans for the FBI to open a hate crime investigation. We understand that the suspect is in custody, and I'll let the best of law enforcement do its work to make sure that justice is served. Until the investigation is complete, I'm necessarily constrained in terms of talking about the details of the case. But I don't need to be constrained about the emotions that tragedies like this raise. I've had to make statements like this too many times. Communities like this have had to endure tragedies like this too many times. We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Now is the time for mourning and for healing. But let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it. I say that recognizing the politics in this town foreclose a lot of those avenues right now. But it'd be wrong for us not to acknowledge it. And at some point, it's going to be important for the American people to come to grips with it. and for us to be able to shift how we think about the issue of gun violence collectively. The fact that this took place in a black church obviously also raises questions about a dark part of our history. This is not the first time that black churches have been attacked. And we know that hatred across races and faiths pose a particular threat to our democracy and our ideals. The good news is I am confident that the outpouring of unity and strength and fellowship and love across Charleston today, from all races, from all faiths, from all places of worship, indicates the degree to which those old vestiges of hatred can be overcome. That certainly was Dr. King's hope just over 50 years ago, after four little girls were killed in a bombing in a black church in Birmingham, Alabama. He said they lived meaningful lives and they died nobly. They say to each of us, Dr. King said, black and white alike, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely with who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderers. Their death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly for the realization of the American dream. And if one will hold on, he will discover that God walks with him and that God is able to lift you from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope and transform dark and desolate valleys into sunlit paths of inner peace. Reverend Pinckney and his congregation understood that spirit. Their Christian faith compelled them to reach out not just to members of their congregation or to members of their own communities, but to all in need. They opened their doors to strangers who might enter a church in search of healing or redemption. Mother Emanuel Church and its congregation have risen before, from flames, from an earthquake, from other dark times, to give hope to generations of Charlestonians. And with our prayers and our love and the buoyancy of hope, it will rise again now as a place of peace. Thank you.
What would you do differently on gun control?
But not everyone thinks it's gun violence that's the problem. Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford sees something deeper. So you heard what the president said. What are your thoughts?
Well, another case of a great presidential diversion. Here we have a racist atrocity of the first order, and all that can prompt our president to do is divert immediately the attention to his call for gun controls. And yet we saw that when there was, on the scale of things, rather minor civil disturbance under great police provocation in Baltimore, the president was calling the folks involved thugs and such. We didn't hear any kind of comments like that about folks like the perpetrator in Charleston. And if he can't make a statement on white supremacy, not just on race in general, like he sometimes does, but about white supremacy, if he can't do that in light of this atrocity, then when can he? And also, what would he have folks do in this kind of situation? What would the president say if there should be a revival, and maybe folks are talking about it right now, of deacons for self-defense, of churches? There's a long history there. What would be his reaction to that? To disarm the deacons? This president does not simply fail to give leadership. He points in the wrong direction and lets the white supremacists get off scot-free. He doesn't even call them thugs.
You know, And not for nothing, the Facebook page of the accused has his photograph, has a pair of flags stitched to it. One is the flag of Rhodesia and the other of apartheid South Africa.
And where do you get these flags? You know, they're already trying to call him some kind of lone wolf, like he just invented this white supremacist ideology all by himself. But clearly, he's hooked in with the paraphernalia as well as the ideology of the armed white separatist movement that is represented by hundreds and hundreds of groups, not just in the South, but all across the country. These are invisible to President Obama, invisible to a national security state that knows what everybody says on the telephone, but can't find or even discuss the existence of these armed groups that are a danger to the life and limb of black women and children and people just going to church.
And speaking of armed groups and communities of color, this president, of course, has been arming around the world insurgents against governments in Africa and the Middle East, for example. Do you see any connection?
I see a connection between lawlessness in the United States and lawlessness by the United States government. I see a connection between young white men in Charleston, South Carolina, who believe that it is their God-given right to defend what they think is their community, and by that they mean the white community, and a president who says the United States can take whatever steps it chooses against whomever it chooses without regard to any notions of law anytime that it feels like it. There is an environment of lawlessness that is promulgated from the very top. And why shouldn't impressionable young racist men in South Carolina feel that they can do the same?
And finally, while we're at the top, the Department of Justice is apparently going to be actively involved in this case. What do you think are the implications for it?
The Department of Justice is not actively involved in keeping track of or even popularizing the existence of these armed groups that have always been there and, according to those who study them, have been on the rise, especially in the last 10 years. And yet we see law enforcement at every level, of course, including the federal government, urging citizens to be on the lookout for, by implication, bearded men who might be from some part of the Middle East, and to rat on their neighbors if they say anything that might be regarded as in opposition to U.S. policy. But again, the white supremacists, these armed groups, are invisible. And of course, well, we have to make the assumption it's because there really is not a policy at the U.S. Justice Department or Homeland Security that considers them to be a danger to the American way of life or to the interests of those who rule.
Charleston's Emmanuel AME Church was burned down nearly 200 years ago as part of a seminal event in U.S. history after Denmark Vesey and five slaves were hanged in July of 1822 for allegedly plotting a revolt that authorities at the time claimed would have involved thousands of enslaved people in Charleston and at nearby plantations. They allegedly plotted to kill slaveholders, free their enslaved workers, and then set sail for Haiti, where black people had thrown off their enslavers in 1804. The slave revolt was planned for June 17th, 1822, the same date that the gunmen walked into Emmanuel AME Church and opened fire. Denmark Vesey, who purchased his freedom in 1799, but was unable to do the same for his wife and children, had helped found the church in 1816, and the congregation quickly swelled to more than 1,800 members. It was closed twice in its first 6 years for violating the state's stringent slave laws. Vesey and his co-conspirators were accused of meeting at the church to plot the rebellion, and city officials, tipped off by other enslaved workers, ordered a militia to arrest Vesey and others just before the revolt was supposed to begin. Vesey and five others were quickly found guilty in a secret trial and condemned to death. They were hanged several days later on July 2, 1822. Panicked whites executed nearly 30 more slaves that month, following secret trials by the city-appointed Court of Magistrates and Freeholders, which tried 131 men through August of that year. Federal troops and the local militia were called in to crack down on widespread demonstrations by angry enslaved people and free African Americans. In response to the demonstrations and criticism from the governor, the court issued what it termed, quote, an official report of the trials of sundry Negroes, closed quote, which serves as the only remaining record of Vesey's life and the alleged plot that led to even more brutal treatment of black people. Charleston's mayor, James Hamilton Jr., blamed the revolt on black Christianity in general and the AME Church specifically, and city officials ordered the congregation to be disbanded and had the church burned down. The congregation continued to meet until all black churches were outlawed altogether in 1834, although they continued to meet in secret until after the Civil War. Eventually, a new church was built in 1891. A mass deportation of Haitians by the government of the Dominican Republic may be coming soon. 500,000 Haitians who are now legally stateless could be deported this week, including people born in the Dominican Republic, after a Dominican court ruled 2 years ago that Haitian migrants to the island dating back as far as 1929 could be stripped of their citizenship. This past Monday, Haitians and Dominicans held a joint protest in New York City outside of the Dominican consulate, holding signs with slogans like ethnic cleansing.
Bataya!
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 Right now, precisely, we're actually in front of the Dominican consulate. I'm here standing in solidarity with Dominicans of Haitian descent who are set to be deported in the hundreds of thousands. There is a government in the world that's denationalizing a people, and there isn't a single international body that's doing something about it.
It is a response by the Dominican government supposedly to regulate in the immigration status of people in the Dominican Republic. But what we understand is that in this process, there are many Dominicans of Haitian descent who have been born in the country who are Dominicans, who should be recognized as Dominicans, that are also being potentially deported with this law as well.
Deportation! Stop the racism! No deportation!
So far, I've seen a lot of support from Haitians, Dominicans, and Americans, and Americans of other Caribbean and South American descent. I'm half Haitian, and my father's actually a leader of the Black Lives Matter in the Dominican Republic movement, and I feel like it's my duty to be here to help support workers in trouble who are being deported and oppressed.
Haitians, Dominicans, black and white, workers of the world unite!
The more protests we have like this all around the world, and the more people we get involved and the more people we educate about this, the better it is for the Haitian people and Haitian Dominicans.
I feel to actually make change, we have to like lobby and do things other than protests and find ways to reach those people who try to ignore us, like the people walking away from here. I feel like this is a good way to start, but I think the next step would be a way to actually engage the masses.
As Dominicans born either here in the United States or who have migrated here to the United States, we should be aware of how this resonates with our own community. We should understand that they are just as Dominicans as anyone who's living in the United States and claims a Dominican nationality.
Our cultures are different, but similar in so many ways. We are brothers and sisters on one island, like both colonized people. And we have liberated ourselves from that, but a lot of us haven't done that mentally. And we need to build that solidarity together in like in places where joy is spread, where there's music, where there's dance, you know, we gotta do that.
Dr. Gerald Horn is an historian who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. We spoke with him via Skype Thursday about the history behind the current assault against Haitians in the Dominican Republic. very bad situation facing people that can't prove that they're Dominican citizens right now.
That is correct, and it has a very long history, as you well know. The Dominican Republic came into existence as an independent country in 1844 in a revolt against the abolitionist regime in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. As a direct result, there is a continuing animosity between the two states, but more than that, there's a continuing resentment, I'm afraid, in the DR, directed disproportionately towards darker-skinned people, even if they're Dominican, who are perceived to be Haitian. You know, I'm sure, that elections are coming up soon in the DR, and when elections come up in the DR, oftentimes, as is in the United States, they play the so-called race card. That is to say, racist sentiment is whipped up against darker-skinned people. And as we speak, as I understand, there are thousands of Haitians being swept up in a dragnet who presumably will be deposited on the other side of the border. This will exacerbate a continuing crisis in Haiti, could worsen bilateral relations, and could lead to results that are too ghastly to contemplate.
It's odd, the dynamics in Dominican Republic, particularly to an American, with the concept of race that Americans have here, I guess exemplified by the one-drop rule. It's almost exactly the opposite there. Most of the people that are fighting over this would be considered black in the United States, right?
Well, that's true to an extent, but it's important to recognize that in many ways this so-called race problem on the island of Hispaniola can be laid at the doorstep of Uncle Sam. Recall that when the DR, or what became the DR, revolted against abolitionist Haiti, it was one of the early counter-revolutionary coups by Washington. Secretary of State John Calhoun, the hawkish South Carolinian, supplied arms and covert assistance to the rebels on the eastern side of the island, and it was the United States propaganda that helped to whip up this hysteria against darker-skinned people on the island. This was driven in no small measure by the fact that Haiti was supporting anti-slave revolts on the North American mainland, including, if you believe certain sources, the revolt of Nat Turner in Southampton, Virginia in 1831, not to mention the revolt in South Carolina of Denmark Vesey in 1822. So this racial problem, if you like, that you see in the DR has Uncle Sam's fingerprints all over it.
Those people who eventually find themselves displaced from their homes in the Dominican Republic won't be alone in their condition. Worldwide displacement from wars, conflict, and persecution is at the highest level ever recorded and accelerating fast. That, according to a new report released by the UN Refugee Agency. The annual Global Trends report shows a sharp escalation in the number of people forced to flee their homes, with almost 60 million people displaced at the end of 2014, compared to 51 million a year earlier. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
Worldwide, UNHCR finds that one in every 122 humans is now either a refugee, internally displaced, or seeking asylum. The agency's Global Trends report says the main acceleration has been since early 2011, when war erupted in Syria, propelling it into becoming the world's single largest driver of displacement. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres said with huge shortages of funding and wide gaps in what he called the global regime for protecting victims of war, people are being abandoned.
We don't have the capacity, and essentially, we don't have the resources to support all the victims of conflict around the world and to provide them with the very minimum level of protection and assistance. We are no longer able to pick up the pieces.
UNHCR's report also shows that almost 9 out of every 10 refugees are in countries considered economically less developed. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The number of people displaced in sub-Saharan Africa has been described as immense in that report. According to it, Africa had 3.7 million refugees and 11.4 million internally displaced people last year. Around 4.5 million were newly displaced during 2014, an increase of 17% over the previous year. Ethiopia replaced Kenya as the largest refugee-hosting country in Africa and the fifth largest worldwide. Journalist Daniel Johnson interviewed Babar Balak, a spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency, to get an overview of the situation in the region.
Africa has been a continent where conflict has affected many people as well. 2014, Central African Republic was there. There were problems in South Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria, Democratic Republic of Congo, and elsewhere. So with all those crises, the numbers in Africa have been up in that sense, 17%. And if there's no way to deal with that problem or in terms of resolving these situations, there's no way that we can deal with this raise in the numbers.
So a serious problem. You're also expecting to be able to spend $200 to $300 million less than you had in 2014 on refugees. So what's your feeling on that?
UNHCR as an agency, the commitment that we are looking from international community as a whole is one that where refugee protection is needed or international protection is needed, people should be allowed to come in. Because for these people, it's a matter of life and death. They can't stay where they are or they will be dead. So keeping the borders open is very important. And that's what we see, that over 86% of these people of the world's refugees are being kept by the neighboring countries. And most of them are developing countries and least developed countries in globally. But also what we are asking is a political will to engage with in situations like Syria, Iraq, Yemen, in Myanmar and Afghanistan to help solve these situations as well. Because if there is no solution, there's no hope at all. And the third one that we're looking for is international community's commitment to keep the funding up. The resources that we have to deal with millions and millions of people is not enough to even do the most minimum for these people.
Meanwhile, the number of people forced by conflict and instability to flee their homes in Asia went up by 31% in 2014, according to the agency, whose spokesperson Babar Balak also explained why the number of people forced to flee there has increased so dramatically. According to United Nations sources, the funding simply does not exist to manage the scale of the problem.
One, two, three, four. Skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love and brother is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.